Hello, John.
Hey, George.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. And
long
you?
Time no see.
Yeah, it's good to be back on Science Saturday with you.
Happy vernal equinox.
Oh yes, vernal equinox.
This week. Yep.
Yeah. The pagan ritual that actually was the basis for the Christian. Celebration of Easter.
Ah, right, and the Easter Bunny and all of that. And
right.
Do you remember there was a great Smothers Brothers routine that was, I think it was actually banned by, or censored by the network censors on the old Smothers Brothers show?
Yeah, I remember the show. I don't remember this incident.
It was an Easter show that they were doing, and then Tommy, you know, who played the dumb one, and then Dickie was the smart brother, and then Dickie was asking Tommy, he's saying, well, do you know what this Sunday is, Tommy? And Tommy said, well, yes, I do, Dickie. It's Easter Sunday. And he said, ah, very good. And what does Easter Sunday signify? And he said, well, that's the day when the crucified Christ rose from the tomb. And Dickie said, very good. And then Tommy goes on, and if he sees his shadow, it means we have 3 more weeks of bad weather.
And they censored that?
Yeah, can you believe that kind of thing that got censored back then? But
times have changed.
Boy, now you can say anything as long as it's not a 4-letter word on network TV.
Yeah, well, even that barrier, I think, will soon be breached if it hasn't
already.
Yeah,
probably.
So, what's been happening in the world of science lately?
Oh, boy, God, I've just been so busy working on articles and... there was, I guess, the big incident this week that caught my caught my notice anyway. It would have to be pretty big to catch my notice this week because I've been buried in a story I'm writing. But Arthur C. Clarke's passing on at the age of 90 at his island Redu in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke, there was a wonderful obituary in the Times, I don't know if you saw it, about Clarke's career and sort of putting it all in one place like that. I was really I've been reading Clarke since I was a kid, and knew that he had been really prescient in lots of ways. For example, he is credited with first having the idea of communication satellites in, I think, the late 40s or early 50s.
Yeah, he actually wrote, it was a paper that he wrote rather than a science fiction story.
I see.
That sounds a little like Al Gore inventing the internet, though.
You know, he still gets a lot of the credit.
Yeah, I think he does, and I think he himself said. I think this might have been in the obit that he himself said that. Well, you know, it's more that I was expressing, you know, an idea that had been in the air, and other people had been, you know, writing about. But it's not like no one else had ever thought of geostationary satellites, I don't think.
Yeah.
Which we should probably explain, their orbits are such that they hover over the same part of the Earth all the time. So they're, in other words, they're turning at the same velocity that the Earth is.
Yeah, and so did Clarke actually propose that as a good place to put communication satellites?
I think so, yeah.
So
I mean, I just know what I read in the obit. That was not something I ever realized.
Because that's pretty,
you know, his
big
role in that. Oh yeah, and then and I guess he, you know, I remember reading, I think Dennis Overby or somebody interviewed him. I don't know if he did in Sri Lanka or when he was in the States, and there or somewhere I remember reading that he had a pretty sophisticated satellite communication set up in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I guess probably the way that Clarke influenced most of us in our generation was through the movie, the Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001, which
yes, the Space Odyssey.
Yeah,
I still don't know if that floating baby in the 10th dimension or something at the end, what that means exactly, but apparently it was a great spiritual message.
Yeah, the ending. Well, you know, back then, so this came out in, what was it, 68?
And, that sounds right. Yeah.
Anyway, when that movie came out, I remember you just had to smoke pot or take some other substance, be under the influence.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Because it was just so psychedelic at the end, and it didn't make any sense to any of us, but that may have been because we were all so high.
No, I don't think so, because I watched it under nothing stronger than Coca-Cola and popcorn, and I still thought, wow, I must be missing all kinds of stuff here and hidden meanings, and if I were only, could add another 10 points to my IQ, I would understand this. And then later you realize that, they're just kind of riffing on a lot of imagery, and although
maybe
I guess there was an underlying message. And then later Clark wrote, after the movie, he wrote a novelization of the movie, which I guess made the plot, more explicit and linear and less psychedelic.
Well, there were a couple of features of that movie that really had a big impact on culture, and not just pop culture, but the scientific culture. One was the evil computer Hal.
right.
Which has been described as the most vivid character that Clark ever created.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a knock against Clark's tendency to be better at expressing grand ideas than creating three-dimensional characters.
Yeah, and that's so true of science fiction in general, and in a lot of the cyberpunk literature. The characters are just kind of they're like little cardboard cutouts or robots that just kind of are there just to get the story across and then describe some interesting ideas, which you read science fiction for the ideas, and then also for just this ability to create these alien worlds. And I think that's where most of the really good talent lies, but not generally in characterization.
Well, the character of Hal was supposedly inspired by things that were happening in artificial intelligence at that time. And in fact, Marvin Minsky, who was one of the creators of AI, was a consultant to the movie. And back in the 60s, Minsky and John McCarthy and some of those the AI pioneers, Herbert Simon, were predicting that within a decade or two, very quickly, computers were going to become intelligent enough to start learning on their own. Start absorbing knowledge on their own. They wouldn't have to be spoon-fed by us. Yeah. And they were quickly going to go racing past us and attain some kind of superhuman intelligence that would be beyond our comprehension.
Yeah.
This is something that scientists were taking very seriously at that time.
Well, and it didn't happen in 10 years, but I think it's slowly going to happen.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah.
I don't. It's funny because some of those same computer scientists from that period, for example, Marvin Minsky recently gave a talk in New York City, and he said, obviously, intelligent computers haven't happened yet. That dream hasn't been fulfilled. He said as an example of how limited computers still are, he said that you can't write a program that allows a computer to distinguish reliably between cats and dogs, which is something that a 4-year-old child can do.
Yeah, but I think so much of that is, originally they thought they were going to solve the speech recognition problem, for example, by all this very intelligent programming.
Mm-hmm.
And, that you would have all these algorithms and software agents so that sound coming in through the microphone to the computer would be parsed, and they would look for phonemes, and then they would cluster the phonemes into words, and you would have there was a software model called Pandemonium that one computer scientist came up with, where you'd have all these little agents. It's kind of similar to Daniel Dennett's view of how consciousness work, all these little agents kind of competing to interpret this fire hose of information that's rushing into this electronic brain, and they worked on that and got some some progress. But when there was really a breakthrough in speech recognition technology, it was when they started using these statistical algorithms, where basically the computer's just programmed to to glean these patterns using statistical kinds of techniques, and you can, you know, and then training it against, this range of sounds statistically is more associated with this word than that word, and that's worked incredibly well. I get emails now from people that that just dictate them.
Yeah, Richard Powers, the novelist, apparently.
We talked about that once.
His novels anymore.
Yeah.
He uses voice recognition technology. I guess the what the AI people hadn't anticipated is how difficult it would be to reproduce not certain little well-defined features of human intelligence, like speech recognition or visual pattern recognition or so forth, but how you put that together in a complete package combined with a kind of common sense knowledge of the world. There was a period when they focused on creating expert systems that could accomplish some very precise task, and there are lots of expert systems out there now, for example, that used in judging loan applications.
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Interpreting cardiograms and so forth. But creating something like HAL, a kind of all-purpose, very human intelligence, that has just, we're not any closer to that now than we were back in...
I think we're a lot closer, but I think it's happening at a network level.
Okay.
I mean, like, just the fact, you know, something that's seemingly trivial is Google and Google searches. Just the amount of intelligence and learning that's built into the Google search algorithms.
But nobody really thinks of those search algorithms as sentient. I mean, you know, that was what was so
but
dramatic
it's a step.
Sentient
I don't know about, but something that acted every bit as though it were sentient, I can imagine.
And this was sort of crucial to science fiction, something that would develop its own goals and even its own sort of emotions and desires.
Yeah.
So that was what made HAL such an interesting
character. That's true.
He turned
out
to be evil.
To survive.
Even
if it meant killing the two astronauts. And was the goal programmed in because some computer programmer thought, well, it'd be good to give this computer a survival instinct because that'll motivate it to do its best in sticky situations out there in space? Or did that somehow emerge from, an unexpected byproduct, kind of an epiphenomenon?
You know, another interesting feature of Clark's career is that he was sort of writing, 2001, and in most of his greatest works occurred in sort of the golden age of U.S. space exploration, when we put man on the moon, and it looked like we would, there was this tremendous momentum, and we were just going to explore the solar system, and then who knew what would happen after that. So you also had shows like Star Trek that were depicting these futures in which we'd be fanning out through the universe and meeting aliens and all that.
Yeah, it's very inspiring stuff, and this idea of transcending our earthly bounds. Ed Rothstein, also in the Times, wrote that essay in trying to make the case that although Clark was an avowed atheist and said he didn't want anyone to do anything religious or pray at his funeral, that as Rothstein reads him, he was very very religious person and not but I think that's not really true. But what was your take on that?
I thought it was an interesting piece. I was sort of surprised to hear that that Clark had insisted on no religious sentiments being expressed at his funeral, because his writings are suffused with, maybe religious is the wrong word, but at least spiritual and even kind of mystical imagery. Yeah. So you mentioned the end of 2001, which was clearly a kind of mystical, mystical in the sense of being pretty obscure. vision of some sort of transcendent human future and the evolution of consciousness. There's this.
Is that what that meant? I don't.
I still don't know what it means. But there's another. I think Clark's greatest novel is Childhood's End, and in that book, there is very explicit religious imagery. So there are these aliens who come to Earth. I think they're called the Overlords, and they are. They have horns. They're dark red. Their skin is dark red. They've got horns coming out the top of their head. They've got a long tail with a little spear point at the end, and they've got these big leathery wings. So they look exactly like medieval depictions of Satan, and they're benign figures for the most part. So they force humans to give up all their weaponry and stop fighting wars and so forth. But then, while they're there, there's this change in young people who all seem to be possessed in some way by this new emergent consciousness. And it's a very mystical idea. I mean, it was a very 60s idea, too.
You know, looked like Halloween costume devils. Did they have pitchforks? I mean, what was he trying to say? I mean, it sounds to me like he was maybe making fun of
that. Yeah, well, I guess it's just the idea. You know, he's just borrowing religious imagery, and he's using it in these sort of ironic ways. But still, the themes that he's exploring are the great themes of religion. So what are we here for? You know, what's the end of humanity? Are we evolving towards some kind of apocalyptic revelation? And, you know, what I like about Clark's work is that usually there's this sort of ambiguity to some of these mystical notions. So the idea that we're all evolving into a cosmic consciousness, which was the theme of Childhood's End, was presented in a way that was, so the parents are sort of looking at their children acting in all these strange ways, and the children are just so intelligent that the parents can't begin to comprehend them, and yet this is presented in a way that's really chilling and even terrifying.
Yeah, God, I don't think I've ever read that, or if I did, it was so long ago that it's gone. But
it sounds great,
but I still wouldn't use the word religious, because to me, religious, you know, means ritualistic, you know, organized religion, and I can kind of see the word spiritual, maybe, although I don't really like that either. But, you know, I think he was really a hardcore scientist. I mean, not as a practicing scientist, but philosophically, and would argue that this kind of omega point sort of convergence cosmic consciousness, you could imagine that all as something that was happening for entirely materialistic reasons, you know, throwing information processing. I mean, he wasn't talking about, you know, like a higher mystical realm where the laws of physics don't apply. And
well, it depends what you mean by mystical. I think Clark is, I see him as part of a strain of scientific speculation that actually used in The End of Science, I called it scientific theology. So you've got people like Freeman Dyson. I think he's one of the best practitioners of this. Is using science and to look into the future and imagine what can happen if you extrapolate certain scientific and technological trends. What can happen with genetic engineering and neural implants and artificial intelligence? How will we transform ourselves? And, you know, there's still this thriving culture of people who, I think, have used science and technology to create a kind of scientific religion. I think one of the most obvious examples of that would be Ray Kurzweil, the artificial intelligence entrepreneur, who thinks that we're on the verge of a singularity in which we might merge with intelligent computers and we develop an intelligence that we can't even imagine now. That just expand almost infinitely, and also...
Well, it's speculative science where you're kind of taking things that are possible and then extrapolating and imagining what might happen if you combine them and what could emerge from that. But you could do that, you know, entirely within the scientific materialistic spirit, I think.
Yeah, but I still think when it gets to a point, I think it's quite fair to call that religious, because I think it stems from the same sort of yearning for transcendence and some kind of ultimate cosmic purpose that leads to, you know, the conventional religions we've had.
Yeah, I guess I buy. I guess I might buy spiritual. But religious is, like, I think of religiously brushing your teeth. You know, religion means doing something ritualistically and being involved in, you know, with dogma and all these things and not questioning received wisdom. And
oh, boy, that's a pretty negative view of religion there, George.
Yeah. But, I mean, to me, that's what the word religion, the word religion... That's what it connotes to me. While spiritual is kind of this sort of mystical, that's kind of circular. Spiritual is kind of this, you know, misty. You know, there's something beyond the material world. There's
it's more
things
about
we can't explain. There's something beyond us. And
more about questions than answers, and it's more open-ended.
Yeah, it's sort of you know, to me, it's too much like believing in ghosts.
Well, it comes
from the same root, you know, spirit and breathing, inspire. I don't know. I probably just have a warped view of the...
you're just like one of those, you know, you're just like Dawkins and Hitchens and those religion bashers. Let me add one more point about, or a couple more points about Clark. One, I think we can agree that the great age of... space exploration and sort of Star Trek fantasies is over. That now
we decided to have the Vietnam War instead.
Well, you know, the Cold War ended, and the space program was really an outgrowth of the Cold War and establishing the power of U.S. science and technology as opposed to that of the Soviet Union. So those
just part of the Cold War. But didn't Clark have a more I mean, he was more had a much more optimistic view or a hopeful view that he thought that space exploration would be this international effort and that it would actually be a substitute for war.
Yeah, that was actually I hadn't known that about Clark. Well, now it seems obvious, but it was mentioned in the obituary that he once called space exploration. He said it could be the moral equivalent of war, which is a phrase that William James used in a famous essay that was published almost exactly 100 years ago, I think. And James was saying that war provided some of the high points of human history. It was this great drama that tested the character of men.
Romanticized view of human slaughter.
Well, it was interesting because this was in an essay on proposing, and James himself was a pacifist, and he's proposing how we could get rid of war.
Yeah.
And he's saying that we need a substitute that can provide this immense existential challenge for especially men. You know, James wasn't really worried about women. Instead of war. And so he actually he proposed this kind of giant public works program in which young men would be enlisted in working in mines and on fishing boats and digging tunnels and doing all these other things that put them in constant danger of losing their lives. It all seems a little...
But they do that anyway, right? I mean...
Well, this is the thing. I never understood why we need a moral equivalent of war, because it seems to me that life is pretty damn hard without having to invent things to make it harder.
Well, yeah, but I guess people do kind of invent them for themselves when they don't have them. You know, they go drag racing or ice climbing with pickaxes and...
Yeah,
Well, you really like to, you, there's that thrill of taking the risks, and I guess that draws some people at the lowest levels into wars.
I guess, I don't know, it seems to me that, this is sort of the old
geopolitical grudge matches.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is the old idea of war as a kind of necessary catharsis for human aggression. It's a very kind of Freudian idea. So Freud and Konrad Lorenz, the Nobel Prize winning biologist, wrote about this later, suggesting that we have this sort of an aggressive drive similar to the sex drive or hunger that builds up and needs periodic release in either war or violence.
So war is wired in.
Yeah.
But you just had a piece in Discover magazine that just came out, right? That completely undermines that.
Yes, thank you.
Or certainly casts it into doubt. So I wish if I had the magazine now, I would hold it up. But I read it online last night, and I just thought it was a terrific article.
Oh, thank you, George. Well, I
really
well
argued.
Right. And so here's the issue of Discover. They didn't think war was important enough to make it the cover story.
What's the cover story?
Big Bang Theory. Yeah, I mean, for Christ's sake, how stale is
What's
that?
New? Is there something new with the Big Bang Theory?
No, it's just more theories about what happened before the Big Bang. I actually talked about that a little bit last week with Sean Carroll. But then here they have a little teaser line. Not my headline. In fact, I don't like it. It's not what the article is about. It says, "Could Iraq be our last war?"
I'm just looking online, and the headline is, "Has science found a way to end all wars?"
Yeah,
and that sort of evokes my rule. My rule about rhetorical questions, that the answer is always no.
Well.
Except, certainly science hasn't found a way to end all wars, but your article actually made me feel a little more optimistic that while, aggression's obviously pretty, something fairly deep and competition for resources, and it all comes down to, survival and proliferation of our genes, that it doesn't necessarily follow that... That means we're going to keep doing this or trying to do this through something as counterproductive as human slaughter on large scales.
The original title for my article through the whole editing process at Discover was, Is War Inevitable? And that was really the question that I wanted to look at. And
I'm kind of convinced it's not now. Don't think I was convinced before I read your article.
I consider that a tremendous accomplishment, George, because I know what a grouchy pessimist you are, and so to have turned you into a kind of naive, romantic optimist like me, I consider that to be that makes me feel really good. But let me just say the reason.
Why don't you give us a little
synopsis,
précis of the article?
Well, first, let me tell you why I decided to write the article in the first place. It was really because after 9/11, I encountered this what to me was a really surprising and disturbing fatalism among people I was talking to about war. And so I thought that 9/11 was obviously shocking and frightening. To me, it makes me worry about the future, the whole concept of suicide terrorism I find very disturbing, but I still am very hopeful, maybe just because I have kids, that we'll figure this out. War is a problem that we can solve. We'll get past it in the way that we've gotten past slavery and human sacrifice and some other unpleasant features of human history. And and I actually did a survey at Stevens of I had some of my students survey their classmates about whether they thought war could ever end, and over 90% of the respondents, and we surveyed more than 200 people in all, said that no, war will never end.
Yeah.
And I asked them to explain their response. And all of them had variations on the theme that war is part of our nature, we're just intrinsically evil and violent and competitive and so forth. And I, you know, I think
there's a lot of good evidence for that.
Well, you know, and this isn't true of just these young people. I've actually been surveying people whenever I have the opportunity, when I give a public lecture, just people I meet at cocktail parties.
Yeah.
I've done some writing on the web. Overwhelmingly, the response is that war is a permanent part of the human condition. We've always fought, and we always will fight. And even if we're not actively engaged in war, there's always the threat of war. We'll always have militarism as part of civilization.
So that's kind of changed from the, you know, the 60s, post-60s. I mean, I was thinking, if you had given that survey to me in, like, 1975 when I was in college, you know, I would have been very idealistic and said, oh, no, you know, war is going to end, and, you know, first we're going to stop the Vietnam War, and then, you know, we're going to figure out a way to transcend, you know, warfare. And, you know, I really believed that. I considered myself a pacifist, and I registered for the draft as a conscientious objector. But, you know, as the years went on, if you'd asked me the question, you know, I would have answered with 90% of your students, I think, that it just seems inevitable. But
see,
I'm not so sure.
I think I can explain why this fatalism has become so prevalent now. Actually, I mentioned in my article that there was a survey done at Wesley. Wesleyan College in the mid-80s, and only about one-third of the students then were fatalistic that war is inevitable.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for the change over the last couple of decades is that there's been this flood of findings from primatology, anthropology, and archaeology primarily, as well as other fields. And there's sort of two big findings that have really pushed in the direction of fatalism. One is the finding that actually emerged in came out of Jane Goodall's chimpanzee reservation in the late 1970s, that chimpanzees in one troop will band together, male chimpanzees, and go patrol their perimeter. If they find chimpanzees from another troop, they will beat the hell out of them and often kill them.
Just for the hell of it, huh?
Well, it's, you know, not
clear
whether
it's... I mean, they're protecting their territory, though.
So it's interpreted in different ways as sort of part of sexual competition, alpha males asserting their dominance, but also...
Yeah, it looks like gangs today with their turf. And
right, but also competition for resources. But it was really disturbing because it was thought that humans were the only species that had lethal... intergroup aggression, and here we discover it in our closest genetic relative, the chimpanzee.
Huh, that didn't really surprise me so much, but I guess I'd always figured that you know, that was true throughout the primate world. But I guess you have to distinguish between, I mean, all animals fight. And sometimes they seem to fight just for the hell of it. At least that's true of our cats. But but I guess you'd have to distinguish between that and in a group.
Right,
banding together to go beat the hell out of another group.
Right, social aggression, and so
social
there
aggression.
Are. We're anthropologists like the best known probably is Richard Wrangham at Harvard, who said that this shows that human social violence goes back probably to the ancestor that we shared with chimpanzees, which goes back more than 5 million years.
Yeah.
Now the other finding, in addition to this discovery of this group violence among chimpanzees, was that sort of contrary to the notion that war emerged only with agriculture and civilization.
Yeah, no. The idea there is that that, you know, when people were hunters and gatherers, they just kind of moved across the land and didn't stake any claims on real estate, and then once they started developing agriculture, they had an interest in protecting a certain specific plot of land, like some something by a stream or at the end of a canyon.
Right.
And then they started building granaries to store their food, and had a reason to protect the granaries because they put in this work. And then if someone else came along and thought, wow, this is really a cool place, they got these great granaries, these great fields, and you know, they could decide, A, go over to the next river valley and do it themselves, or B, get a bunch of clubs and come, you know, soaring in and take it over. And
right.
So the idea was that that warfare begins with agriculture and staking of turf.
Well, so what has happened is that anthropologists and archaeologists have looked at both the evidence from archaeological digs and at societies that are still alive today who are thought to be living in ways that might be similar to those of, for example, hunter-gatherers tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years ago. And it turns out that almost every society, I mean, there have been these exhaustive surveys done, more than 95% of all the societies that have been examined engage in warfare at least occasionally.
Yeah.
And warfare can be, and this might mean just, you know, two guys, a guy and his brother ambushing a guy in another tribe who's been messing around with their girlfriend or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as you get a group together and they're committing violence against each other, then that's considered to be warfare. But the levels of violence were thought to be extraordinarily high. So there was a very influential book called War Before Civilization by a guy named Lawrence Keeley that came out in 1996. And he did this survey of hunter-gatherers, chiefdoms, all sorts of pre-state tribes, and found very high levels of violence, averaging anywhere from 10% to as high as 50% mortality rates from violence.
And this was before they were developing agriculture and...
And before modern weapons.
Before modern weapons. So, yeah, so that's obviously good ammunition to say that it's endemic, so...
Well, it totally shatters the idea going back to Rousseau of that warfare is basically a disease of modern civilization. So Rousseau had this phrase, the noble savage... Which suggests that, you know, in their natural state, meaning before civilization, the corruption of civilization, humans all got along with each other. They lived sort of like hippies. They made love, not war. They shared. They were also living in harmony with nature.
Yeah, right.
I think, for me anyway, the archaeology and anthropology has pretty much demolished what's now called the myth of the noble savage, peaceful savage. But there, so you know, people have heard all these findings have kind of filtered down to popular culture, and I think have fed this fatalism. Meanwhile, some of the same scientists who are responsible for that this work are saying that repudiating fatalism themselves. So when they address the question of whether or not war can be reduced or eliminated, most of them are quite hopeful.
Yeah.
They point out, for example, that changing environmental conditions for chimpanzees and bonobos and monkeys and other primates can dramatically change levels of aggression.
Mm-hmm.
There was a study done by this guy named Robert Sapolsky, who's one of the he's one of the really interesting scientists doing work in this area, and he has been studying a troop of baboons since the early 80s.
Oh, they're nasty creatures.
Baboons are. Edward Wilson once said about baboons that if they ever acquired nuclear weapons, the Earth would be destroyed within 10 minutes. It's a great quote. Actually, Sapolsky quoted that in this paper that he wrote for Foreign Affairs of all places, on the implications of some of this research. And so in this particular paper, Sapolsky presented all the findings about the violence of chimpanzees and other primates. But then he talked about Forest Troop, this group he'd been watching, which had all its alpha males, all the toughest, biggest, meanest males, were wiped out because they'd all been foraging in this garbage dump where only the bravest, toughest males would go.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they'd all been, they'd all contracted tuberculosis from contaminated meat. And so it was this kind of social experiment. Get rid of all the tough males, and what happens to your society? Yeah. And what happened was that what had been thought to be very hardwired behavior among the baboons changed really dramatically. It became a kind of more matriarchal society. Mm. There were males still in the society, but they went so far as to, they didn't fight all the time. They even groomed each other, which Sapolsky said is about
baboons,
is about as likely as you know, sprouting wings.
Yeah, so it was just a few bad baboons that were giving the rest of them a bad reputation.
And it was, and this,
and that's
is
amazing.
Persistent.
I mean, yeah, you would think, I would have guessed that you know, they would have just replicated the, you know, the previous structure, and new alphas would move in or emerge, and you'd be back to this violent society. But no.
And it's persisted even through several generations. So there, you know, there are new males coming in from the outside and being born and raised within this group, and this kind of peaceful matriarchal structure.
Yeah.
Which is actually very similar to that of the bonobos, or these chimpanzee like creatures who are much nicer than chimpanzees.
Right.
It's really persisted.
Yeah.
So that's one sign of hope. Another big reason for hope is that the levels of violence, you know, this is sort of the flip side of the destruction of the myth of the noble savage. That actually things are getting a lot better. So I mentioned that the levels of violence in the average primitive society were, you know, about 20% mortality rates.
Mm-hmm.
In the 20th century, this is something that Lawrence Keeley mentioned in the book War Before Civilization. In the 20th century, the total death rate from war and war-related causes, genocide, mass famine in the Soviet Union and so forth, was about 1-2% of the population, depending on how you count it and define it.
1-2% in the throughout the 20th century?
Throughout the 20th century, and that's about an order of magnitude less than the mortality rate from violent death in your average pre-state society. So, George, things are getting better.
So rise in population isn't necessarily linearly related to rise in social violence.
No, not at all.
Social
aggression. I think it's obvious that, again, that, you know, so people are led to fatalism by the idea that you know, that there was no such thing as the noble savage, but that means that civilization, even though, of course, civilization can lead to and has led to more sophisticated weapons technologies and so forth, civilization is also giving us the means of resolving disputes without bashing each other over the head or strapping explosives onto ourselves and blowing up our neighbors.
Well, that's what really impressed me when I read your article that, you know, I guess a lot of my pessimism came from just the sociobiological or evolutionary psych view that, you know, our behavior is obviously an outgrowth of the evolutionary drive to spread our genes as widely as possible into the gene pool, and that if we're competing for resources or territory or mates, that naturally there's going to be this built-in tendency to do anything that you can to carry out that ends, at least, you know, while you're still of breeding age. And that the natural, obvious shortcut way to do that is, you know, violence. But, you know, as it turns out that, you know, clearly warfare and violence can be very counterproductive to that very same genetic end, and that as brains develop and we're able to, you know, process more information as we communicate more with more different people across wider gaps, that we're able to develop these other strategies that are actually more beneficial genetically than warfare is.
Well, this is something that was stressed by even Richard Wrangham, who wrote this book, Demonic Males, that links aggression among chimpanzees and humans, males who commit the vast bulk of violent acts. He links that to the male reproductive drive. He says, basically, it's the tough guys get all the girls. And he's even got this amazing passage in Demonic Males where he says, let's face it, when you go to a typical bar situation, the sensitive guy sipping his glass of Chablis doesn't get the girl. It's the, the bad guy.
But now we have internet dating.
Right.
So there's a whole, we have all these new technologies and communications devices and a whole other layer of symbolic structure. So it's entirely possible that the guy sipping Chardonnay is going to, be perceived as being a much more desirable mate, especially if it's a really good Chardonnay and obviously has the discrimination that, indicates that he has his own resources and will be a good protective father. And
well, what Wrangham said, his book presents this really cartoonish picture of males. And but when I interviewed him, he said that he regretted one aspect of his book. It made it sound as though that male violence is compulsive and it's sort of instinctual and
hardwired. Yeah, I thought that was his whole point.
And he said that actually, both among chimpanzees and other primates and obviously among humans, there's always a lot of calculation and rationality behind violence. Because otherwise, if you're compulsively violent, you're going to be killed fairly quickly yourself.
Yeah.
This is something that's been emphasized by Napoleon Chagnon, for example, the anthropologist who was the first to study in detail this tribe called the Yanomamo,
right,
in which fighting is very common. And Chagnon said that presented evidence that the most violent males, those who had killed the most in battle, also had the most wives and offspring.
Yeah.
But Chagnon was always very careful to emphasize that these weren't sociopathic, compulsive killers. There are people like that in Yanomamo society. They're almost always killed very soon themselves.
They weed them out.
Because nobody wants to live with people like that. The warriors are usually very calculating, and if they see other ways to get lots of girls and status and resources, Chagnon said, they will pursue those avenues.
Yeah, no, I'm finding that pretty convincing because, obviously, violence and aggression is always going to be part of your toolkit.
Right.
And it's always going to be, one of the strategies. But, as people, as the brain is developed, is to some extent, we're more loosely coupled to our genetic substrate, and we can, we still might have the same primal urges, but we can think about them and argue against them.
Right, and it's just so clear that, especially now, I think one positive coming out of the Iraq war is that it just shows that at this point, war is really, there's this tremendous downside, and it's hard to see much of an upside from this war at this point. And, if you believe that we are, to an extent, rational creatures, then I think many of us are accepting that war just, it might have made sense in certain situations, and it certainly did make sense in certain situations in the past, but at this point, it really doesn't.
But isn't there a big difference, though, between war, like ancient war that would, maybe there's not, but let me think, war that would would break out kind of spontaneously between two groups over resources, like the nice bend in the river with the fields. And the situation now where a relatively small group of people in the Bush administration, for example, citing so-called secret information that turns out not to have been reliable or true, can launch something of the effort of the war in Iraq. So it's, no matter how much, society evolves, you could imagine society culturally evolving to the point where it's less likely that you have gang warfare, breaking out in cities among groups of rival gangs, just kind of spontaneously wanting to fight, in a case where a few people can, calculate and scheme and have this immense leverage to where, their odd little predilections and world views can be, leveraged into this huge war.
Well, that's
bringing out all these resources that are at their command, and
that's definitely true.
People into supporting it, and then going on, and then having the ability to go on and wage the war long after there's any public support for it left.
Well, this is one reason why, you've probably heard about this correlation between democracy and peace. So it was actually Kant who first, in the late 1700s, I think, wrote an essay called Perpetual Peace, and he suggests, even then, there was evidence that democracies, even though there were few democracies then, Kant said democracies don't seem to fight each other very often or at all, so maybe that is our route to peace. And there's this whole field of scholarship now that explores what's called the democratic peace phenomenon. And I think it's linked to what you just said, that you're much more likely to get war if you've got small groups of leaders who aren't necessarily answerable to their citizens, and they see war as being very much in their own selfish interests, even if it's not in the interests of their followers. And through propaganda or just coercion, they can coerce their followers into going to war. And the democratic process just makes that a little bit more difficult to happen. Although, as we saw Iraq, it still can happen.
But one of the reasons, it's hard to look at that as just being an exception proving the rule. That seems to really kind of fly in the face of that, doesn't it?
What, the Iraq invasion? Except it wasn't an invasion of another democracy. So there, actually, since the end of World War II, you get apparently the benefits of democracy are compounded if you get when you have one democracy and some kind of conflict with another. But one of the there's actually been this precipitous decline in classic nation against nation wars. Again, the U.S. invasion of Iraq is obviously an exception to that. But since World War II, and we actually are in a period now where some scholars are talking about the end of conventional war.
Yeah.
And some say that, and even civil wars are declining in number over the last 15 years. And this is the same period when you've had an increase in the number of democracies from about 20 to almost 100 today.
Yeah.
So there's some people who see that as a very optimistic trend. Just one other.
Another thing would be, I would think just generally increasing prosperity.
Yes,
would be linked to that. But still, I don't know how. It seems like the hardest thing to get at in any of these theories is this ideological layer, where you can have people going to war because of some combination of memes, in their mind, something that they believe. And whether it's a religious war or another kind of ideological warfare that... how do you get a handle on that? I mean, that seems to be something that was probably less of a factor, maybe 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago.
I don't know. You had the Crusades.
Or maybe not.
Yeah, you know, there are certainly ideological wars back then, too. I mean, this is an endless debate among war scholars.
But I guess some people would say that the ideological aspects are just kind of an epiphenomenon of some struggle for resources. And
right.
Yeah, because there was a study I was just reading about at the, you know, in the Hopi Mesas, there was this village there called Oraibi, O-R-A-I-B-I. And sometime around 1900, the village basically fractured into two opposing factions, and one of them kind of pulled up and then built another village nearby. And it's been a big debate ever since among anthropologists and ethnologists as to what happened and what caused this split. And the dominant view was that, you know, drought conditions had put extra pressure, there was more competition for resources, and that this exacerbated some natural tensions that were already in the society. So I guess the big question is the chicken and egg thing of whether the, you know, which was the, you know, which side the trigger came from. And
it's exactly the same argument that we're having now as to whether Iraq was really about ideology, whether it's fundamentalist Islam,
is it just simply blood for oil, as they,
just oil,
you know, on the protest signs, which seems to be ridiculously simplistic view, or to the other extreme, was it this ideology of protecting our precious bodily fluids and our way of life, and
I think it's
bringing democracy
both
to the world?
I think the way I think about it is that war is overdetermined. In other words, that there are many different possible causes of war, none of which is absolutely necessary, but you could have a subset of those causes that are sufficient to cause war in a particular situation. And so when you're thinking about how to create a permanent peace, you want to overdetermine that peace as well and work toward peace on as many different fronts as possible. So ensuring a more equitable distribution of resources is obviously a good idea. Trying to confront and suppress or discourage lethal ideologies, an ideology that would lead you to commit suicide bombing.
But you try to suppress them, and then they just feed on that.
Try to show them in an enlightened way that it's just not a great idea.
If people can become convinced or convince themselves that the aggression is bad for them,
right,
and for their society, and that's why I guess my optimism would come from just the amazing communication technologies we have now. So whenever there's a war, people all over the world, even if they don't have a TV in their shack or their tent, they're probably going to have access to one, you know, in a village center or something, and they're actually seeing what war looks like. So it becomes less of an abstract thing where you can think, the glory of let's rise up and have our team go over and beat up the people in the next village and take their granaries. And, you know, now they can see what happens when you engage in this kind of warfare, and that there's, you know, that you might actually get, you know, clubbed on the head yourself and slaughtered.
More
people can see the consequences of that, and then know for their own selfish reasons that it's not a good idea and that it's a losing situation.
Except that, so that helped us get out of Vietnam, bringing the war into people's living rooms, but it also leads to, you know, it exacerbates hostility toward the United States occupation of Iraq when images of mutilated Iraqi children are beamed around the world.
In that case, it could incite people to violence, you know, out of outrage. So it's not clear.
It goes in both ways. Actually, Bob Wright has written in a very intelligent way about this sort of paradox of global communications. Mm-hmm. You know, one other, I've got to mention, since I realize we're getting close to an hour, one other really positive trend that I mentioned in my article, and that a whole bunch of people I've spoken to have emphasized, is maybe the single best way to encourage peace and reduce conflict in the future, and that's education of females. So there is a correlation, a very strong statistical correlation, between educating women, young women, girls, and decreasing birth rate in developing regions. Actually, developed, whatever. It happens where it happens in virtually every society. So you get women who are educated, entering the workforce, they're less likely to have children. You get population rates going down. You get less stress on the environment, less competition for resources. You get this cascade of positive effects which help us in lots of different ways, including the reduction of conflict, just by funneling your efforts into educating females.
So does this mean you're supporting Hillary Clinton for president?
Well, it's funny, because actually one of the, I think I've mentioned this on a previous Blogging Heads.
Yeah.
Franz de Waal, one of the primatologists I spoke to for my article, has done a lot of studies of chimpanzees and bonobos and, mm-hmm. and so forth. He said that he believes very strongly that more involvement of females in positions of power and so forth would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And it's right in its own sake, but also he thinks it would lead to less war. But he points out that there have been some very bellicose female leaders, Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, and he also says that there is evidence from primate studies as well as studies of humans that show that females, even though they might get into conflicts more reluctantly than men, tend to hold grudges and to hang on to a conflicted situation longer than males do.
Yeah.
So I actually asked him if he wanted to comment on the relevance of that to the current presidential race,
yeah, did he?
And he declined.
Yeah, smart man. Well, yeah, and controlling population would that just seems like such an obviously important factor, and yet, we can control populations in the so-called developed world, but then if it's not happening internationally, you're just going to get immigration, and immigration tends to, you have people of, different cultures moving into other established areas, and then these feelings of competition arise and aggression, and so it seems like, a long shot that that's going to have an effect anytime.
But even with these immigrant
groups, within the next century or two,
as soon as these people are put in situations where, as long as they allow young women to take advantage of their educational opportunities, you still get this same effect of a fall in birth rate.
I think it's good. That's very encouraging. I just am not encouraged that it's going to happen anytime soon. Because you can have pockets of that kind of enlightenment, but as long as most of the world remains with this huge population pressure problems and limited resources, and I don't know.
But the first step towards solving this problem, George, is to reject fatalism and to believe that we can solve the problem.
Yeah.
You have to have faith. This is a faith that's based on empirical evidence.
I do, especially after reading your fine article and just this notion that, the competition to spread your genes is as endemic as anything can possibly be, that there's different strategies for doing this.
But, something I got to mention, this is actually something that a guy named Steve LeBlanc, he's an archaeologist at Harvard, pointed out to me. He wrote a book called Constant Battles.
Yeah, he's in your article, and I think he's done some Southwest archaeology.
He has, and he's a really interesting guy. He's very sort of feisty and belligerent himself, but he says that, Rousseau was totally wrong. Yeah. We've always been fighting like crazy, the whole idea that that North American Indians were sort of, you know, these pre-hippies and, and living in spiritual communion with nature. It was total bullshit that they were all killing each other and ravaging the land. But he said it was all about resources, and he really thinks that the linkage of all this to the male reproductive drive is pretty shaky. He pointed out that many of the most rich and powerful men in the world nowadays are content to have a single mate and maybe one or two kids, like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or people like that. They don't have gigantic harems of women. They are, you know, they're happy to. The coupling of male power and status and so forth to the number of offspring you have is actually
loosened, because again, it's a case where, you know, when you can think and process information and learn from experience, you can develop different strategies. And,
there are other ways that people can fulfill themselves. So yeah, Genghis Khan, he's often mentioned by the people who defend a Darwinian view of warfare as this warlord who had literally thousands of children. You know, now we have Bill Gates. That's progress. Progress, George. There's reason for
it. I think you're making progress, and just the fact that at least within the United States or within most countries, something like war, you know, the closest thing we have is maybe LA gang wars.
Right.
And they're nothing like, you know, wars like you used to have all the time within, you know, like throughout Europe. And when something like that does happen within a country or within a region with like a similar culture like Western Europe, it's, you know, obviously extremely newsworthy, so it becomes like the exception.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I think
it's not just the fact that it's so remarkable when it happens. So I'm willing to be optimistic. And
okay, well, that's, well, I think we should end right there.
I think we should end right there on that optimistic note before Easter Sunday.
Yeah, and also if anything else I say, you might become pessimistic again. So I should
probably a good idea.
Quit while I'm ahead.
Yeah.